I grew up in Oregon exploring all of the amazing places that people who came before me worked to protect. And so it's that idea that someone was doing this for my benefit when I was younger, and I have a role and a duty to step in and make sure that future generations can enjoy the things that I, along with my colleagues here and our partners across the state, work to protect.
Good morning, I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, a natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wilderness, and special places. From the beaches to the mountains to the deserts, this is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use the show with caution, because you might just learn something. We are recording the program on location today in Portland, Oregon, at the offices of Oregon Wild. Oregon Wild has been working to preserve Oregon's forests, mountains, coastline, and high desert open space since the organization was formed in 1974. Oregon Wild has preserved nearly 1.7 million acres of designated wilderness in Oregon and has also helped ensure 1,800 miles of wild and scenic river designations, including the Mighty Rogue River in the southwestern corner of the state. Powered by an active grassroots citizens network, Oregon Wild has made the preservation of the state's remaining old-growth forests and watersheds a priority, as well as protecting hiking, backpacking, and fishing opportunities. In addition, Oregon Wild is working to cut down on habitat dissection around the state and ensuring environmental laws are enforced. While Oregon Wild advocates for the creation of wilderness and roadless areas like the Calmeopsis and Devil's Staircase, and the expansion of wilderness areas around Mount Hood, Crater Lake, Mount Tielson, and in the Rogue River Valley, they've had a number of more pressing issues come up over the last few years, including ongoing controversies over the ONC lands, or Old Railroad Company Oregon and California lands. They've also been contending with funding issues regarding the Secure Rural Schools Act, ongoing fallout from the Western Oregon Plans Revision, or WOPR, and ensuring the safety of wolves released back into the wild in Oregon. So we're going to try and cover as many of these topics as we can, and joining us today to talk more about Oregon Wild's many projects is the organization's executive director, Sean Stevens. Sean, thank you for having us at your office today to record the show, and welcome to Tree Huggers International. We are very happy to have you on the program.
Thanks, Tommy. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start the conversation by talking a little bit about the name change. Why the name change when you already had some branding with the previous name?
You're hitting on a little bit of it right there, because we were the Oregon Natural Resources Council, but many people thought we were the Oregon Natural Resources Defense Council, some branch of NRDC rather than our own entity. And so that was one reason. There was just confusion. Are we part of NRDC? Are we a state agency that's doing something to exploit natural resources rather than protect them? So there was confusion, and that was part of it. But additionally, we reached a point where, you know, we had that name ONRC, and it really meant a lot to a lot of people, but it didn't speak to people that weren't members. They didn't really know what we did. And Oregon Wild really speaks to everything that we're about. We're about protecting wild places for people, for wildlife, for their own sake. And so the name change came about from a desire to have our values better reflected in the name of the organization.
More succinct, and brevity is genius.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about the ONC lands. They are managed not by the Forest Service, but by the Federal Bureau of Land Management, or the BLM. Can you talk about the history of the ONC lands and why the future of these lands is unclear?
Yeah, it's a quirk of history, because the BLM really doesn't manage much forest in the rest of the country. They're mostly a desert or other types of land across the country. But in Oregon, we had this history where, as you mentioned in the intro, the Oregon and California Railroad was given a bunch of land to build a railroad from the north part of Oregon down to the south part of Oregon. And all this stretches across the Coast Range and out. And so basically, they started building the railroad, but then they also started speculating on the land. And the federal government said, no, you're not going to do that. We didn't give you that land so that you could flip it and turn a profit on it. And they took it back. And so the feds took this land back. And in 1937, there was a law passed called the ONC Act. And it basically charted the course for these lands for the next 80 years. And the ONC Act, it had language about sustained timber production, but it also had language about protecting watersheds and recreation opportunities. But it also specifically designated more of the receipts, the money that came into the federal government from timber sales and other activities, to go to local counties. And so you had all this land, and I guess I should describe what it looks like on a map. It's often called the checkerboard, mm-hmm. because these were square mile chunks interspersed with square mile private land chunks. And so if you look at a map of the ONC lands in Western Oregon, all down the coast range and spreading out, you see this checkerboard pattern of 1 square mile that's public and 1 square mile that's private, which is a management difficulty in and of itself. You know, the Forest Service at least deals with more contiguous blocks of land. Now, there are some bigger chunks on the ONC lands, the Rogue being one portion. There's Forest Service Rogue, and then along the stretch of the Wild and Scenic, there's also a BLM chunk that's contiguous, 58,000 acres, an area that we're actually working to protect as wilderness. But when this land was revested with the federal government, it went into management under the Bureau of Land Management, and it did have this special law that dictated what it was supposed to do. And for many years, especially in the 70s and 80s, when we were cutting old growth timber in Oregon like it was nobody's business, they were getting a lot of money from the federal government in the form of timber sale receipts. When the Northwest Forest Plan came around, it redesigned what everything looked like in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington when it came to old growth forest, mature forest, forests that coho salmon and spotted owl relied on. And that changed the dynamic on ONC lands. It reduced timber harvest, and it meant that there was less money flowing into county coffers because of it.
In the 1930s was when the Oregon and California Railroad were trying to flip the land, basically, back then.
It was actually before then. And finally, in 1937, you had the law that laid out what the management was going to look like on ONC lands. The lands were actually revested even before 1937. It was only in 1937 that Congress said, here's what we want you to do with this land. BLM's going to manage it, and this is what they're going to do with it.
Okay, so the BLM has always been managing that since...
Since 1937.
To be clear, these lands don't necessarily fall under roadless categorization. Is that correct?
They don't, because they're not Forest Service lands. The roadless reviews that happened in the 70s were a product of the Wilderness Act. And the Wilderness Act did something for Forest Service and something for BLM. BLM did wilderness study areas, and the Forest Service did roadless areas. It's actually something that I think has gotten lost in the last, 50 years of the history of the Wilderness Act. Those processes were meant to identify the lands that were then to be designated by Congress. Mm-hmm. In the original act, you had some areas that were protected, and then you had a few more in 1968. But really, the Forest Service was supposed to go out, and the BLM, and find those areas that deserved wilderness protection and recommend them to Congress. That's what roadless areas are. Now, there's been quibbling over whether or not the Forest Service did a good enough job with roadless area review. That's why you had two roadless area review processes, RARE 1 and RARE 2. That's why Oregon Wild formed in 1974, was to monitor that process and make sure the Forest Service and BLM were doing a good job of identifying areas that would qualify for wilderness. Lo and behold, they left a bunch out, and that's why we have 2 million acres of roadless forests in Oregon, but there's about 5 million identified by conservationists that fit the bill of the Wilderness Act. So.
And are those areas mostly in the coast ranges? Are there any in the eastern part of the state?
Oh, they're all over, actually. The coast range, it's pretty well hammered, from a history of logging. It's lower elevation, and so it was easier to get to and easier to log. There are only a few spots left that are really wilderness quality still. One of them is the Devil's Staircase that we're working to protect as wilderness. And there aren't Forest Service lands in the Coast Range, really. You have to go all the way out to the foothills of the Coast Range and the coast to get to the Siuslaw, Law. And then you go further down and you're out of the Coast Range. You're into the Klamath Siskiyou, Cascade Siskiyou area. And then you have Rogue, Siskiyou National Forest. And then further east, Fremont, Wainema.
So what are some areas within those areas you mentioned that are potentially threatened by mismanagement or misappropriation of ONC lands? I mean, are there some particularly spectacular roadless areas that need to be protected now?
There are. I mean, the Rogue is the prime example. You have in 1978, the Forest Service land along the Wild and Scenic Rogue was protected. And you have a wilderness there that's further down. So, when you're about a day and a half into your Rogue float trip, that's when you hit wilderness. Otherwise, you're on a wild and scenic stretch, But looking up towards the crest of the mountains, all those forests are not protected, and those are on BLM O&C lands. And there were old growth timber sales as recently as 5 years ago in those areas that Oregon Wild and others had to sue to stop, which we were successful in doing. And then we realized, you know, we should use this threat as an opportunity to say, this has always been wilderness quality. It should have been included in the original 1978 bill. Let's protect the rest of the wild rogue. That's a poster child on O&C lands for a really special place. Actually, another place is a small pocket of roadless area called Crabtree Valley. That's in the Salem BLM, so closer to the north part of the state, closer to the population center. Used to be owned by Willamette Industries, which was later bought out by Weyerhaeuser. But in the 70s and 80s, there was quite a fervor over protecting this place because Willamette had plans to log it. And this has some of the oldest Doug fir in the state, 900,000-year-old trees, and around a beautiful lake. And the land got swapped, so the BLM traded some of their land and took over management of Crabtree Valley. Some of Crabtree Valley was included in the Western Oregon Plan revision that you mentioned, which was the Bush administration's attempt at revising the management plan for the O&C lands to really increase harvest and increase, unfortunately, old growth clear cutting. Luckily, that was defeated both by the Obama administration, who recognized it was so flawed that they pulled it, but also later in court.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the Western Oregon Plans revision because that was, well, it was a response to the Northwest Forest Plan passed in the mid-1990s. It seemed the Northwest Forest Plan wasn't a perfect piece of legislation, but it was light years away from what Whopper was proposing.
Yeah, I mean, and to get a little context on the Northwest Forest Plan, in the 70s and 80s, logging on public lands really ramped up for a couple of reasons. One, you had basically the bulldozer so that you had the track wheel that you could come in and really get greater access to the forest. But also, private lands had really been hammered already. And those private timber barons turned to the public lands. And that's why you had a huge increase in the 70s and 80s. By the time we knew there were issues with what we were doing to the ecology of old growth forests, and we knew there were problems with salmon health and health of the northern spotted owl, it was a little bit too late in the eyes of politicians and timber interests to do anything, and they actually increased harvest so that by the late 80s and 88 and 89, we had the biggest public timber harvest in history of 5.5 billion board feet, billion with a B, in Oregon.
On
federal land alone in 1988. So that big last gasp of huge old growth logging spurt, that led to the more, you know, the sudden decrease with the listing of the spotted owl. There was some court wrangling after the owl was listed in 91. And then we had to come back and form this Northwest Forest Plan, which, as you mentioned, it was an imperfect document. But what it did is it gave, for the first time, a science-based look at the whole region and said, if we're going to have old growth forests in the future, if we're going to have species living in those old growth forests that have called them home for centuries, we're going to need to change. And here's the model. Did that protect all old growth? No. And that's been a big problem with the Northwest Forest Plan ever since. And it's what conservationists and timber interests have continued to fight over. The Whopper really was the attempt to take the O&C lands, these BLM lands, out of the context of the Northwest Forest Plan and really increase harvest on those lands. And again, they have this weird historical significance because 75% of the receipts from timber sales go to counties. And so there has been this view historically from these 18 O&C counties that this land is their land, not your land, even though it's federal land. And so it has been difficult, and that plays into one of your questions off the top, which was secure rural schools and funding for rural counties.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that. But so you mentioned that Whopper, in a lot of ways, took some of these lands out of Forest Service oversight and into BLM oversight, and therefore, because they were no longer covered by the Northwest Forest Plan, they didn't have to go by streamside buffers, you know, basically protecting clean water and salmon.
Exactly. The new management plan, because it was a departure from the Northwest Forest Plan, which, as you mentioned, has pretty specific rules for protecting aquatic systems, stream buffers. It has the reserve system, so you have matrix lands, which are the lands that you're able to go in and cut. And then you have late successional reserves, which are the mature old growth forests or forests that you want to grow in to be mature and old growth forests, since we have such a lack of those from the history of logging. the Whopper did away with all those things. It greatly reduced the buffers so that instead of being 300 feet away from a stream, you were 50 feet away and you could log that close. It undid the matrix system, LSR system, so that there was far more open to harvest, including old growth forests, which that's been the heart of the argument for so long. We only have about 10% of our old growth left across the Northwest.
You mentioned the Northern Spotted Owl and the Endangered Species Act. You know, the timber wars are typically thought of as that period from about 1988 to perhaps the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Would you say, and I know the legalities are complex, but would you say that that timber wars era, did that come to define Oregon Wild's mission in a way?
You know, it's a really interesting question because, as I mentioned earlier, we were founded around this activism that was generated after the Wilderness Act passed, after the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. That sort of milieu was where a lot of groups formed because it was this push across the country to do something to finally protect our land, our water, our air. And we did wilderness, really, at the start. We said, okay, what are the roadless areas that deserve wilderness protection, and let's go fight for them. So in 1978 and 1984, wilderness bills passed in Oregon. In 84, a really big wilderness bill, 800,000 acres of wilderness. And we were the key lead group in Oregon working on those protections. And those were big victories for us. And then I think, you know, timber had been tied up in it because timber interests didn't want wilderness. They wanted lands to be left open to logging. But things really did come to a head when everyone started to realize how much we were losing as far as our old growth ecosystems and, you know, that species were coming close to being extinct from it. And when that realization started to sink in the mid-80s, we really did turn a lot of our focus towards that effort. And it was a regional effort because, you know, these forests are contiguous and the ecosystem is from Northern California all the way into BC. And so if we were going to win this battle, we had to not just fight in Oregon and Washington, but we had to make the campaign national in scope. And that's what the Ancient Forest Campaign in the mid and late 80s was. It was groups from Oregon, Northern California, Washington, working and sometimes dragging the national groups along to do something to protect the owl, to protect salmon, to protect our way of life here in Oregon, and do something to make sure that, you know, there were old growth forests around for future generations.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International. I'm Tommy Howe, and we're recording the show today on location in Portland, Oregon, at the headquarters of Oregon Wild. And we're talking to Oregon Wild's Executive Director, Sean Stevens. Now, for more information on Oregon Wild's current initiatives and campaigns and additional details on the topics we've been going over today, go to OregonWild.org. That's OregonWild.org.
How long have you been with Oregon Wild?
I've been with Oregon Wild for about 5 years. I started as a communications staffer here and slowly took on more responsibilities and now find myself sort of running the show, I guess, with lots of help. But it means a lot to me to be working for this organization. I grew up here. I grew up in Oregon exploring all of the amazing places that people who came before me at Oregon Wild worked to protect. And so it's that idea that someone was doing this for my benefit when I was younger, and I have a role and a duty to step in and make sure that future generations can enjoy the things that I, along with my colleagues here and our partners across the state, work to protect.
Let's talk a moment about the Secure Rural Schools Act. Funding for the act recently came to an end, and can you explain what it is? You sort of touched on it mm-hmm. earlier. And how this affects Oregon Wild areas, and especially all that timberland, like in Josephine County, southwestern corner of the state.
So the Secure Rural Schools Act came about because of the Northwest Forest Plan and a reduction in timber harvest on federal land. As I mentioned, on the ONC lands, it's a 75% receipts returned to the counties. On Forest Service lands, it's 50%. It's more controlled on Forest Service lands. It has to go to roads, schools. But the idea is when the timber harvest reduced, Congress wanted to do something to replace some of that funding and provide a bridge so that these economies could transition away from being reliant on the boom and bust timber economy. A couple of things happened that were unfortunate, though. One, Secure Rural Schools was pegged to the highest harvest ever on public lands. So we took that late 80s number and we said, whatever millions of dollars these counties got that year, that's what we're going to give them under Secure Rural Schools, which is pretty untenable long term because of just the sheer dollar figures. But Secure Rural Schools did a good thing in that it removed the connection and the incentive to log old growth forests to fund rural schools, because we don't want to be impoverishing our natural world to send our kids to school. In fact, we need the natural world to have something for them to both explore and learn about, but also to provide clean water, clean air, and all the things that our natural systems do. And so that was a good thing that the Secure Rural Schools did. It decoupled timber harvest from county payments. Fast forward, this program continues. It gets these emergency extensions right as it's about to expire. And there's a lot of pressure across the country, from other congressional folks that aren't in Oregon and aren't in the West that don't see the benefit of this to discontinue the program. And it's been, sort of the line in the sand issue for almost all Oregon senators and representatives to make sure they do something to fight for Secure Rural Schools, county payments as it's known. With the budget climate and the political climate as it is today, it's been even more of an uphill battle than before. And really, I think the payments have stopped. The last payments went out for 2011. And if anything happens, it's only going to be a one-year extension. And what that means is that counties that haven't done anything to prepare for the end of Secure Rural Schools payments are in trouble. Those that have done something to prepare, whether by socking away money or by reducing services, have had to come to a new reality where they're not getting the same handout from the feds. Another layer to this complexity, because it is a complex issue, is that many of these rural counties have the lowest property tax rates in Oregon. And so they've been reliant on this federal money and haven't done anything to update their tax structure to account for the fact that it's going away. I've heard people on our staff refer to it that many of these counties have gotten used to Cadillac services for Yugo tax rates. And that's going to have to change with the expiration of Secure Rural Schools. And there's also going to have to be a realization that more money is going to have to come from all fronts, property taxes, maybe money from the state in the form of increased harvest tax, and maybe some money still from the feds, because there's still a ramp down that can happen in those funds to continue to smooth the transition.
But there are also voices calling for additional logging on federal land.
Certainly.
To beef up the money they're getting back.
Well, and this is one of the areas where conservationists find themselves, in a tough spot, because it's very easy for many of these rural counties and their leaders, who are often very close with the timber industry, to point the finger at us and say that, the reduction in logging that happened in the mid-90s is to be blamed on conservationists, and therefore the lack of county funding and the fact that, we're letting people out of jails and we're going to have to cut back on school days. It's very easy to blame that on conservationists. It's an oversimplification of the issue. But what happens is, okay, then the solution's more logging if we're not going to get these payments anymore. There are several problems with that. One, we don't have enough old growth logs to fund counties in perpetuity. And two, we don't even have a market right now for timber that would allow us to get anything close to what the counties need to fund themselves. And that's the path we took before, and that was the failed path, and that's why we need a new direction for funding counties that doesn't rely on selling off the natural heritage of future generations.
Yeah, I mean, that's more of a finite resource than coal. You're going to run out of timber, then what are your schools going to do?
Well, and what's interesting is it's true that if you base it on the model of logging old growth and clear cutting old growth, there's going to be an end date. And we were already reaching that point in the 80s. That was part of the reason that people went so nuts in the late 80s was there's not much left. Let's go get it now. But what we've found over the last 10 years with the Northwest Forest Plan in place is there are a lot of opportunities out on the landscape to do logging in restoration context where you're still providing some wood to the mills, you're providing jobs, but you're actually improving the natural functioning of the forest rather than degrading it through clear cutting. And through things like stewardship contracting, where BLM or Forest Service units get to retain the money that they earn from timber sales so that they can plow it back into watershed restoration and other things. And through collaborative groups, where Oregon Wild sits down at a table with our former foes in the timber industry, with folks from watershed councils and other locals, and with the Forest Service or BLM. And instead of the federal government saying, here's our plan, what do you think of it? They actually sit down at a table and come up with the plan with all the stakeholders beforehand. The Siusla National Forest on the flanks of the Coast Range, it's a classic example, is the first forest to start doing stewardship contracting. It was one of the places where they were logging the most old growth in Oregon back in the 80s. Now all they do is restoration thinning based on a collaborative group model. They haven't had a timber sale appealed in 15 years. They're one of the highest producing forests in the Northwest, and that's what we're saying is the future. Let's go in and restore all these areas that have been hacked to pieces and now are just plantations rather than actual forests. And let's do something to provide jobs, provide wood products, but actually restore the forest. And that's where the opportunity is, not turning back to the 80s and going after old growth again.
I know there are a lot of roadless areas and potential wilderness areas, wilderness study areas in the state, which Oregon Wild would like to spend more time and resources advocating for. Can you talk about some potential wilderness or wild and scenic initiatives which may be feasible? I mean, you mentioned the Devil's Staircase earlier, which is a remarkable area.
Yeah, I can mention a few. I mean, it's good to set the context here because in Oregon, we like to think of ourselves as pretty green. You know, we had the nation's first bottle bill and we did the beach bill. But when it comes to federal lands and our forests, we're lagging a little bit behind, and part of that's because of our political history and the dominance of the timber industry. But when you think about wilderness and protecting wilderness, and wilderness is the highest level of protection we have. Congress has to designate it. It's the gold standard. No wilderness has ever been undone. And that's one of the reasons that Oregon Wild works on that, because we love the permanence of it. We love that we can protect an area, and we know that for generations ahead, it's going to be protected. But in Oregon, we're not doing as well as our neighbors. Idaho has about 8% of their land protected as wilderness. Washington's about 10%. California's 15%. You want to take a stab at Oregon's percentage?
4 or 5%.
You got it, 4. So we're at 4, and we just passed a wilderness bill in 2009 to add 200,000 acres to that. But that's not balance. You know, we have the opportunity, because we have so many special places. We have the opportunity to raise that number and really do something to protect land and find a balance between protection and other uses. That's, you know, our continued challenge. Some of the areas that we're working on right now, we mentioned the Devil's Staircase. That's about 30,000 acres. It's in the Coast Range. It's really an area that wasn't logged because it was so steep and hard to get to. Mm-hmm. It's named after this waterfall that's in the heart of the proposal called the Devil's Staircase Waterfall. Really hard to get to, a full day's hike. No trails in this forest, game trails that you have to kind of follow and make your way. So pretty easy to get lost in as well. But a really amazing place with big old growth cedars and Doug firs and salmon and steelhead in Franklin and Wasson Creeks that flow through it. Really amazing place that actually was left out of the 1984 wilderness bill proposed. But, you know, in the horse trading that led to the finalization of that bill, it got left out. And then I mentioned the Wild Rogue. That's about 60,000 acres and 93 miles of wild and scenic rivers adjacent to the existing Rogue Wilderness, a place that should have been protected then. Some of the state's best fishing, some of the strongest salmon runs still in the state. Obviously, a place that's internationally known for rafting and kayaking. It's the quintessential wilderness rafting trip. You know, one of those places that you have to go if that's what you love to do. And then just great hiking and wildlife habitat. You can see bald eagles and black bears, and you can go down to Rainy Falls at the top of the whitewater rafting section and see salmon jumping in the fall. And so that's a place that's been introduced in Congress, and we're working to finalize that. Another area that we're working on is a wild scenic river closer to Portland. It's the Malala Wild and Scenic River. Provides drinking water for the cities of Canby and Malala. It's a recreation corridor that's used by a lot of river users, whether it's rafters, kayakers, fishermen. And there's been a local alliance that's been working on this place for a while, and it started as cleaning it up because it used to be kind of a trash heap. And you know, we asked if there's opportunities. Actually, the Congressman Schrader, who's the 5th District, it's in his district, Kurt Schrader, he was going to come out and wanted to be part of a cleanup on the river. And the Malala River Alliance, who we've worked with to protect the place, they said, sorry, we don't have anything left to clean up, because they'd done so much to repair, you know, and get all the trash out. And so now the next step is to protect it as a wild and scenic corridor so that it can draw more attention to it as a recreation haven, but also protect that watershed for clean drinking water, et cetera. Those are ones that have been in the hopper for a while, things that people have been working on and have all been introduced in Congress and have passed the House or done various different things over the last couple of years. And so whenever the political climate, there's a window there where Congress is a little less crazy, we expect to be able to push those through for final protection. But as important as those areas are, they're not the big wilderness areas that are going to do anything to make a dent in Oregon's wilderness deficit. And the thing that we're looking at next for that is a 500,000 plus acre proposal along the Southern Cascades, which would be anchored by Crater Lake. The backcountry of Crater Lake National Park has been recommended for wilderness protection by the National Park Service for 30 years now. And so that's about 170,000 acres right there. But then you've got the stretch along the Southern Cascades down to Pelican Butte, up along north of the park, additions around Mount Thielson, because the the rock and ice at Mount Thielson is protected, but down the forest below, Mount Bailey on the other side of Diamond Lake is unprotected roadless area that deserves wilderness protection. But the cool thing about this proposal is that it would protect a 90-mile stretch along the crest of the Cascades where the PCT goes through with only 4 road crossings, which is great for wildlife. When we're thinking about climate change and the impacts that's going to have, we need those north-south migration corridors so that when climate zones shift to the north, wildlife have a place to go that looks like where they used to call home. Similarly, this is a really cool proposal because it protects the headwaters of 3 of the most important rivers in Oregon, the Klamath, the Rogue, and the Umpqua. All of those headwaters start in that area, and even the Deschutes you're getting into a little bit the further north you go. The Rogue River runs from the flanks of Crater Lake. It comes from springs at the edge of Crater Lake. It is one of Oregon's most important rivers, and so protecting the headwaters of the Rogue is really important.
There are wilderness areas already established in the Crater Lake area. So it's a matter of adding on to some of those wilderness areas?
Yeah, so if you look at a map, you see the park itself, which none of it is wilderness. And a good clarification there is that, you know, national parks allow for development like lodges. You know, there's the classic park lodges. Crater Lake has one. If you go to Yosemite, you go to the Ahwahnee. If you go to Yellowstone, there's Yellowstone Lodge right next to Old Faithful. Then there's roads. Wilderness is protected for the wildness, and so you're not going to build roads, you're not going to build lodges, but you're able to go hike and canoe and do all those fun things out in wilderness. Once you get away from the roads and the park itself, there's a lot of backcountry that is eligible for wilderness and should be protected. If you look at a map beyond the park boundaries, there are some wilderness areas that exist close to that, the Sky Lakes being the biggest and the closest. As I mentioned, the peak of Mount Thielson is protected as a wilderness area. You go further north and you get into the Diamond Peak Wilderness and some others. But there are all these, there's 170,000 acres about in the backcountry of the park. And so that leaves you, 330 plus thousand acres of wilderness quality lands that are in that area that are roadless but unprotected. And so there's plenty of territory out there to protect. And if you look at the map, you really see sort of the existing protections, and then you overlay these new protections, and it's just this solid area along the Southern Cascades that would be protected as wilderness.
And then there's some potential additions to the Mount Hood Wilderness.
Yeah, and that was our most recent campaign that we worked on for about 10 years. And then in 2009, Congress passed a big wilderness package across the country, and it included 127,000 acres around Mount Hood and in the Columbia River Gorge. And then a few other areas across the state, Spring Basin along the John Day, Badlands outside of Bend. Those are BLM wilderness areas. Soda Mountain in southern Oregon inside the Cascades-Siskiyou National Monument. And then one more on the coast called Copper Salmon, where the Elk River flows through and out to the coast near Port Orford. So we had those 200,000 acres protected, and we had the Mount Hood bill. But because we had some opposition from then-Senator Gordon Smith, who has since been replaced by our new freshman senator, Jeff Merkley, we didn't get some areas around Mount Hood that were really important, both ecologically and for recreation purposes. And so we're circling back around now and trying to work with a coalition to push those to the forefront so we can basically finish off and protect the last roadless areas on the Mount Hood National Forest. Areas that many people probably expect are protected, like Tamanawis Falls on the east side of Mount Hood, an amazing hike to, you know, one of the coolest waterfalls in Oregon that not everybody knows about.
But in an area of heavy use.
In an area of reasonably heavy use. You know, one of the things that Congress likes to do with wilderness is not designate really frequented areas, because there's a belief that that flies in the face of the intent of the Wilderness Act, which calls for, you know, less human presence and more wildness. And so, you know, if you've got a trail, you know, a good example is a spot on Mount Hood, actually, that we protected, Twin Lakes. The trail that goes up along until you hit the spur trail was not included in the wilderness because it was viewed as that it had too much use. And so, but once you got to that spur trail and fewer people were heading up there, it made sense. And so there is sort of that dividing line. But with Tamanawis, it's just a roadless area that has amazing qualities, not least of which is this really amazing waterfall at the end of the trail. But that's part of the Mount Hood Additions proposal that we're looking at. And it's about 18,000 acres. And like I said, you know, protecting the last roadless forests on Mount Hood.
Not to exclude Eastern Oregon, are there any particular wilderness opportunities like in the Blue Mountains or the Hell's Canyon area?
There's a lot of roadless forest out in Eastern Oregon. You know, the Ochoco is one of our favorite places, is Lookout Mountain out there, 30,000 acre roadless area that has, you climb up to the top of Lookout Mountain and you can see from Mount McLaughlin up to Adams and beyond. It's a pretty amazing place and really diverse, beautiful ponderosa forests. And then, of course, you know, there are big additions that can be made along the John Day, in Hell's Canyon, in the Blues. The Blue Mountains has a big management unit there that the Forest Service has been thinking about wilderness recommendations. And we have about 1 million acres that we've identified in our roadless inventories. And the Forest Service itself has several hundred thousand acres. Unfortunately, the draft plan was only going to recommend for protection something like 17, 20,000 acres. So that's an area that we have to continue to work on. One of the things about Eastern Oregon is politically, it's more challenging. It's more rural, which tends to mean that there's less support for protecting wilderness and other natural resources. It's Representative Greg Walden's district, and he's proven to not be a friend to the conservation movement. And so there are opportunities, but there are long-term plans that really have to be built from the ground up and invest a lot of time and resources in promoting those places. They're also far away from the population centers, which is good for them because it means they get less use and can stay more ecologically intact. But it's not good when you're trying to protect them, because sometimes it's a popularity contest, and that's our job, is to make things, even if they're far away, popular.
Oregon Wild has recently taken to advocating for wolves in the state. And this is an interesting topic, and it can be a little bit touchy. I mean, there is this strange, lingering superstition about wolves. I suppose that movie The Grey didn't really help much. But are wolves as threatened in Oregon as they may be in states like Idaho or Montana?
to look at the Idaho and Montana issue, there are a lot more wolves in Idaho and Montana. The story of wolf recovery in the West starts in central Idaho and in Yellowstone National Park. There were only a few left because we'd exterminated them through state-sponsored trapping and hunting programs. The last wolf in Oregon was killed in 1947, collected for a bounty, really close to Crater Lake National Park, actually. But in 1994-95, the federal government took to reintroducing wolves to Yellowstone and central Idaho. A small population grew pretty quickly, and today there are less than 2,000 in the region, in part because there's been a significant sport hunt over the last year in Idaho and Montana, where close to 600 wolves have been killed in those two states through trapping and through just good old-fashioned hop on your ATV and chase a wolf down. So it's been a challenge. You know, they were removed from the Endangered Species Act by Congress, the first time Congress had ever done that. That was back in 2011 when they were finalizing the budget. And it was a rider on the budget deal introduced by Senator John Tester, a Democrat from Montana. And so, you know, the story in the Northern Rockies is one that's tenuous right now. The population is going to decline there for the first time since they were reintroduced, which is not a trend that you want to see for a species that's very, very endangered still in North America. And Oregon's wolves are going to come from Idaho. That's how the first wolf that came here swam across the Snake River. And actually, the first wolf that came back to Oregon was darted, put in a box, and shipped right back to Idaho. And it's a funny story, but it also gave us time to come up with a management plan in the meantime. And then in 2009, I believe, is when we had the first pups. We have four packs in Oregon and then some outlier wolves, about 30 in the state right now. Scientists estimate that if all good habitat was filled up, we could have about 1,000. So, you know, we're in the very, very early stages of wolf recovery. We've already seen, though, that there's going to be some of that lingering fear of wolves that is playing out in Northeast Oregon, where they're returning right now. But we've also had some amazing success stories. You might have heard of a wolf, OR7. We did a naming contest, and he got nicknamed Journey. And he got nicknamed Journey because he's traveled several thousand miles from his home range in the Omnaha country where he was born, came down across the Ochocos, skirted by Newberry National Monument, came down through right next to Crater Lake, and in a moment of very historical significance, passed right by where the last wolf was killed, and he became the first wolf west of the Cascades in 60 years. And then he kept on going down into California and became the first wolf in California in 95 years. He's been hopscotching the Oregon-California border. What he's doing is looking for a mate. He's going to be hard-pressed to find one down there.
Wow, poor guy. Man.
But it's been an amazing story because it's brought so much attention to wolf recovery in Oregon and the possibilities of what could be. It is sort of this a little bit of a sad story because you know that he's not going to find a mate because back 100 years ago, we killed all the wolves that used to live there. But it's also a hopeful story because it tells you how resilient wolves are, what they can do if we give them the time and the space to do it. And there's no doubt that someday if we don't continue to kill wolves in Idaho and Montana and we give them a safe place in Oregon, that there will be wolves in Northern California. And that, you know, wolves like OR7 that make a trip that far to find a mate will be able to do it and they'll be able to start their own packs. And for us, getting involved in wolf recovery, it's just a natural extension of all of the work that we've done for 38 years. We protect wildlands, wildlife, and waters. We've always done wilderness because people enjoy it, but because wilderness, big wild areas are the best places for wildlife. Big wild areas are the best places for wolves.
It demonstrates those corridors are working.
Exactly, and that was one of the really exciting things about Journey's path is our wilderness coordinator, Eric Fernandez, he joked, like, he must have had a guide to Oregon wilderness areas because that's exactly where he went. He went through roadless and wilderness areas because those are the places where wild animals face the least threat from our, you know, human incursion into their habitat. And continuing to protect those areas is really important to maintain wildlife populations.
Sean, I really appreciate you having us here today to record the show, and I'm really glad we're able to make some time to have you on the program. Oregon Wild is doing a lot of really great things, and we just appreciate what you're doing to keep those wilderness areas intact, and also fighting the good fight, keeping people honest.
Well, it takes a lot of folks and a lot of passionate people to make it happen, and so we're lucky to have support from a lot of folks to get it done. Thanks for having us on.
That's going to wrap things up for this edition of Tree Huggers International. I'm Tommy Hamm. Thanks once again to our guest, Sean Stevens, the Executive Director of Oregon Wild in Portland, Oregon. Thanks also to the staff of Oregon Wild for their hospitality and welcoming us into their offices to record this show. Again, more information on Oregon Wild and their current initiatives and campaigns, go to www.oregonwild.org. That's oregonwild.org. For more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, go to the Tree Huggers International website, www.treehuggersintl.com. That's treehuggersintl.com. You can also find social media outlets for Tree Huggers International at Facebook and Twitter. And our Twitter account is at treehuggersintl. Tree Huggers International content is also available on iTunes. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International. We'll be back again with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wilderness, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Lace up your boots, get on the trail, and enjoy the rest of your weekend. Be well.